I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Over the last 30 years, so contends my guest now, there's been a prolonged propaganda campaign mounted by business to influence the public by taking over the media agenda, thus influencing our thoughts on the important issues of the day, whether it's Medicare and wondering if it's tenable, climate change, whether humans are really causing it, or the idea of Canada integrating itself further with the United States economically and more. These ideas have been seen, have seen much media coverage and promotion. Donald Gutstein has written a fascinating page-turning, thought-provoking book, Not a Conspiracy Theory, How Business Propaganda Hijacks Democracy. It gives evidence, examples of think tanks we've come to know, like the Fraser Institute, the C.D. Howe Institute, and more, and their connections to big business. As well, we read how organizations are able to harness the media to propagate their message. Donald Gutstein taught in the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University and is the author of three acclaimed and also controversial books, Econ, How the Internet Undermines Democracy, The New Landlords, and Vancouver Limited. He's studied media for over 30 years, co-directing Project Censored and Newswatch Canada. He's appeared in various publications such as Maclean's, Vancouver, The Tyee, the Georgia Strait, and Straight Goods. Not a Conspiracy Theory is published by Key Porter Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Donald Gutstein. Good morning, Professor Gutstein.
Hello there, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us. So the three issues where you focus on are climate change, Medicare, and continental integration. We'll take those separately. Let's start with climate change. In the book, you give examples of industry investing millions of dollars in what some people call junk science. Now, when did that all begin?
Well, it began about 20 years ago, actually, when the first indications of global warming were coming to scientists' attention. And it was 1988, actually, when a NASA scientist said, I'm almost 99% certain that global warming is here. And immediately, industry kind of mobilized to counter any of the messages that and research that would be coming out of the United Nations-sponsored bodies.
So the so-called junk science. Is it untrue? Are the findings that the business say and these the research that counters the argument of climate change, are they just false?
It's a difficult area, and it's hard to say what's true and false. But what is absolutely known is that over 2,000 climate scientists have come to a very difficult consensus that global warming is occurring, that it's caused mainly by man's activities, and then it's going to have very severe effects on us. And so even within that consensus, there's science that may be later disputed or negated. You know, that's the way science works, always moving forward. But this is different. This is a very a well-paid effort to undermine the whole project, to niggle away at the findings and to deny, to cast doubt, to undermine. And so it's not that there's the science is wrong. Some scientists who have come to conclusions that global warming is not occurring, that are within the mainstream, those particular scientists have been promoted and hyped by the denial industry. So there's a number of things going on there.
And has this had an effect, do you think, on the public's perception on climate change, on their views?
Oh, yes, it's had a tremendous effect. A few months ago, an Ipsos survey found that 45% of Canadians think that we shouldn't do anything about climate change until the recession is behind us, whenever that might be, you know. So, yes, there's a lot... cause a lot of doubt and confusion in the public mind.
This phrase, Made in Canada Solution, we've heard that a lot over the last decade or so. In the book, you discuss that and where that came from.
Right. Well, it was an industry created phrase. I tracked it down through the databases to find the first occurrence of that phrase in terms of climate change, and it was the outgoing president of Imperial Oil talking to business reporters in Calgary, and that was picked up by the industry, by the media, and turned into a reality, when in fact there never was a Made in Canada solution. There still isn't today.
So that's just sort of a diversionary sort of thing, right?
Oh, yes. It's an alternative to Kyoto, you know, wherever Kyoto is. Sounds foreign and strange, but Made in Canada is something we can all get behind and support that. And so it's been quite successful in kind of changing public perception about what really needs to be done.
You've obviously been following the debate over Medicare in the United States, right?
To some extent, it's way too it would be way too time consuming.
Yeah.
But I have, to some extent, yes.
Are some of the arguments that are used against healthcare, against universal healthcare in the United States, have they been used here? And did you suspect that some of them will be used here in the future, do you think?
Well, a lot of what's happening in the States is coming from the Fraser Institute and from Atlantic Institute for Market Studies. They're going down to the States and don't even think of a public option, because look how terrible Canadian Medicare is. Don't even consider a public option in what you're doing. So it's basically been exporting propaganda from Canada to the U.S.
And in terms of the Medicare debate and the healthcare debate, have you seen over the years a great rise in the public skepticism over whether it'll survive here?
Yes, well, I've tried to track the public opinion polling over the years, and very clearly there's been a fairly sharp decline in confidence that Medicare will survive in the future, although it's still people rely on it and consider it to be one of Canada's greatest accomplishments.
And so what motivates then the Fraser Institute or the Brian Crowley outfit? What's that, the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, in terms of Medicare? Is that the pharmaceutical industry? Who is that?
Well, I'd say it's a meeting of ideology and business. That is, these type of think tanks like the Fraser Institute and Ames in Halifax are basically libertarian-oriented in their ideology, following Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek. They're still the big heroes of the think tank. So there's a belief that government can't do anything, and you should leave everything to the private sector, and things will work out for the best. So there is that. But then, of course, business sees, aha, these are just the guys we need. So over the years, they've been pumping millions of dollars into these organizations to help them do the research, put together their studies, and disseminate them widely through the media. So it's the pharmaceutical industry plus the ideology of the think tank itself.
Now, in the book, you spend a lot of time talking about the Fraser Institute and how successful they have been. They've almost been a brand in terms of just how frequent we see them in the media and the sort. Were you able to uncover sort of their plans that I guess you weren't really supposed to see, or we were supposed to see, right?
Well, there was that one, the 5-year, I guess you would call it like a media penetration document.
Yeah, and what
it was. It was supposed to have been internal, but somehow it got leaked and picked up by a couple of the media, and I got a copy of it. And of course, that time is long past. It was 1997 to 2002, but it shows very clearly the importance of getting the message into the media. I mean, without that, the think tank is powerless, has no influence whatsoever.
Now, do you think their success in getting out there in the media, do you think that's a good promotion on their part, or do you think it's just a symptom of the state of the media and journalism, that journalists perhaps are not, that they aren't doing their research?
It's a combination. As I say, the Fraser Institute has a very large, sophisticated communications department whose job is to get as many media hits as possible and even target their research so that they can hit specific markets. I'll just give you a quick example. So like when they do the school report cards that sort of say which schools score the highest.
Right.
Then they will find the schools and the communities that scored highest, and they will tailor media releases just to go into the newspapers in those towns. And that, you know, so that's part of it. The other part of it is that no question the media have become way more conservative over the last 10 or 15 years. And a lot of that I attribute in my book to the work of Conrad Black, when he controlled 60 of Canada's 105 daily newspapers, and he set out to make the media more conservative, and the book talks about a number of the things that he did to achieve that, and it's still in effect today, so that there are more conservative libertarian columnists more amenable to just writing about what the Fraser Institute puts out without any critical thought.
So someone who's looked at the media for a long time now, what do you think needs to change in the media? Do we need to have more, perhaps, left-leaning columnists in the paper and the sort?
Well, one of the things is, I know a lot of people suspect that there's things wrong with the media. You see more and more of that sort of on blogs and on alternative news sites and so on. But I don't think people are aware enough of how distorted the system is, and that's hard to change, because the way people find out about things is through the media. So if the media are not going to talk about themselves, so it's very difficult. And I think like alternative news sources like the Tie plays a really valuable role in making people aware of the problems in the media, and you need to know what the problems are first before you can come up with solutions.
Are you saying then that the media consumer is not savvy enough, that you're not giving them enough credit perhaps to know what's real and what's true?
I think that it's very difficult to distinguish between the news and the propaganda. And just for the average news reader or television viewer, you don't have time. Like when a certain source is quoted in a newspaper, I mean, I often, if it's a story of interest to me, I sort of Google that person and see who he is and spend some time tracking him down to see what the spin is on the story. But I don't think most people have the time to do that. And so they need a more critical, I wish they could do that, quite frankly. That would go a long way to helping people understand the media.
Back to the Fraser Institute for just a sec here. One of the things you talk about in the book, you discuss, I guess, what is it? I forget the name of the outfit now. Some outfit in the tobacco industry had given the Fraser Institute $120,000.
Right.
And what was promised there?
Okay, there was a British American Tobacco Company, right? And
okay.
The Fraser Institute wrote to them in the year 2000 asking for $100,000 a year to fund, two centers, but the one that's still in effect today was the Center for Risk and Regulation. And what they said, if you give us this money, what we will do, we will attack those people who are advocating for smoke-free environments. For instance, we will attack the people who are critical of genetically modified foods. And, oh, by the way, we're going to ask those companies for money as well. So to me, it's like, quote, the smoking gun. Rarely can you see the connection between the funding and the Fraser Institute output as clearly as you could see in that situation.
And when you confront the Fraser Institute, say, with this sort of information, what's their response?
Well, they say that no trustee, these are the people who are on their board of trustees, and at the time there was a guy from from Imasco, Imperial Tobacco, which was the British American Tobacco subsidiary. He was on the board. Probably these people are on the board because they supply money to the operation. But they've always said that no trustee can tell the think tank what to do. And I accept that because they don't have to. They're on the board because they know already what they're doing and they're supporting it. So I think it's just kind of a bit of deception on their part. And until the media demand that the Fraser Institute tell them where the money for a study comes from, they should refuse to report it.
The idea of continental integration, that's been debated a lot over the last decade or more. Do you think that it's still something that'll be discussed in the future? I mean, I we don't hear it as much, say, as climate change, but that's something that you discuss in the book. Do you feel that the Harper government and people of his ilk, that this is something that's on their agenda?
Well, yes, it's always on their agenda, but the format, I think, with the transition from the Bush to the Obama administration in the U.S., they're now rethinking the strategies for how to deepen the integration. It's going to be something quite different because, like the Canadian sponsor, which was the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, they've said, you know, okay, we're going to need a different approach now. And so it's sort of up in the air. It's probably not on the top of their policy agendas today, but probably by next year or the year after, they'll be coming up with a different strategy. Because what's happened over the last 7 or 8 years was in connection with 9/11 in the United States and the George Bush administration and strategies for how to integrate the Canadian and American business classes. So as I say, that's probably going to change in the next year or two.
And we saw that, didn't we, with taking security and public safety as sort of a backdoor way into greater integration, and then that led to the economy and then the sort, right?
That's right, the security and prosperity partnership. That's what's tying those two concepts together. The Americans wanted security, the Canadians wanted prosperity. So let's bring them together and make them into one issue that you cannot take apart. And so that was the strategy that they consciously developed, and I really tried to document that in the first chapter in my book.
It's just fascinating to read all this and the examples of the media that you give that we've obviously come across over the years. Danielle Smith, you write about her in the book.
Oh,
you,
yeah.
You mention her in the book. She is now the, I guess she's the leader of the Wild Rose Party in Alberta.
Right.
She's had a sort of an interesting rise to that position, right?
That's right, yes. Followed her career starting as a Fraser Institute intern, and then going to Calgary and becoming an editorial page writer for the Calgary Herald just when the newsroom went out on strike for a first contract, and then leaving that and for a couple of years hosting a Global Sunday show on Global TV, and then now going into politics. Very interesting career so far.
A few years ago, we had a couple of authors on regarding rebuilding the Canadian Right, which was this book that these two conservative activists had written about, just lamenting the fact that the Liberals were in power for so long, and that some of their ideas in terms of bringing the conservative brand back, and one of the things they talked about was building this conservative infrastructure in terms of the media, like you have in the United States, where you have think tanks and sort of media outlets that are geared to as repositories for, repositories for conservative columnists and points of view and the sort. You talk about this in the book as well. Are you seeing this sort of conservative infrastructure building? Has it been built?
Yes. It's an interesting question. I read their book at the time, and I thought, well, it's already happening. A lot had already been put in place by the time they wrote their book in terms of supportive media, a network of conservative think tanks across Canada, generations of students who had gone through the Fraser Institute's student recruitment and training programs and were in a place in politics, in government, in media, in other think tanks, in academia. Like you look across at some of the Canadian universities, there's a whole backlog of, shall I say, conservative scholars in place. So there already were a lot of the elements for the conservative infrastructure in place when they wrote their book. And since then, and of course, importantly, funding for it, think tank funding. In the book, I talk about the Donner Canadian Foundation, which was the paymaster that really single-handedly helped establish the network, and then other foundations like the Max Bell Foundation and so on, the Galen Weston Foundation. So I think all of the elements of the conservative information infrastructure are in place in Canada. Certainly it's not as vibrant and as large, and it doesn't have as much impact as the one in the States, but I think that time might come.
Now, is it your goal then to destroy that infrastructure so that it doesn't exist in this country?
I can't do anything to destroy it, but what I can do is sort of document it, try to publicize it, thanks through programs like yours, publicize it, and try to work towards a more level playing field in terms of public policy discourse to encourage the development of a similar kind of infrastructure on the left, so that the public at least can get balanced perspectives on issues.
And how is the effort on the left going?
I think the left has realized the magnitude of the problem. There's certainly moves afoot to try and work towards a more established infrastructure, but we have to recognize that the Fraser Institute set out to do this 35 years ago, and so it takes a long time and a perspective, and I think the left is just starting to get that vision.
See, it's funny, Professor Gutsy, because we hear in the United States a great deal about how the media is inherently liberal, and you have, what's the guy's name in The Citizen in Ottawa, David Warren.
Oh, yeah.
He accuses the Canadian media of being the same, and when we read your book, you obviously don't think that.
Well, I don't, and in fact, a lot of what's happened in the last 35 years came out of a key document that that a conservative lawyer in 1971, Lewis Powell, who was soon to be nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, he wrote this 500,000-word document about what business had to do in order to regain the upper hand in the American democracy. And one of the things was a media strategy. And what came out of that was what they call flack, to attack the media and accuse it of being liberal, and at the same time infiltrating the media and bringing in more conservative people. But the two-pronged attack pushes the media to the right. And so that's what's happened. There are organizations in the U.S. whose only purpose is to criticize the media for being too liberal. And we see similar things in Canada. For a couple of years, the Fraser Institute had a division called On Balance, whose purpose was to attack the CBC and accuse it of being too liberal. but they haven't had the same effort in Canada, David Warren aside, to do that.
Professor Gutstein, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. This is a stimulating book, as I said off the top, and just a I sat up with it over the weekend. Just a page-turning book almost. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck.
Thank you very much. It's been great talking to you. I've really appreciated it.
And the same. The book is called Not a Conspiracy Theory, How Business Propaganda Hijacks Democracy. It's published by Key Porter Books. Its author, Professor Donald Gutstein on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.